Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Richard Ford is one of America's most highly revered writers. His novel Independence Day was the first to win both the Pulitzer Prize and the Pen Faulkner Award, and captured great critical acclaim, like his other novels, in the Bascom Trilogy, The Sports Writer, and The Lay of the Land. Now comes his first novel in 6 years, Canada, which tells the story of 15-year-old Dale Parsons' abrupt and reluctant coming of age, as the secure, insulated world he knows suddenly shatters when his parents become unlikely bank robbers and he exits his home in Great Falls, Montana, for Saskatchewan, Canada. It is an uncompromising tale in which a host of transgressions, including the robbery, kidnapping, abandonment, and murder, shape the life of its protagonist. It is a great pleasure to welcome Richard Ford back to The Book Show. Thank you very much for with us.
It's a pleasure. I'm happy for you to get all those transgressions into the book.
There are a lot of transgressions in this book.
Yes, there are. It's really a book about how normal life gives way through the agency of our behavior, transgressive behavior, so that normal life goes away and never comes back. It's about crossing those little invisible borderlines between normal behavior and very extra normal behavior.
And it's one of those things that always has you questioning what normal is, of course.
It should.
Yes.
And how tenuous it is and how close we are to a complete, you know, destruction of everything that we know. I guess I grew up feeling that way, and I don't know why. Sometimes people say to me, well, you write about dire things, and yet you grew up in a happy childhood. I was an only child of parents who really loved me. And I think that's because when you do grow up in a situation like that, you're very aware of what could happen that would cause it all to end. Mm. And in my particular life, it all ended rather abruptly by my father dying when I was 16.
Where you were present and witnessed it.
I was, yes.
And that has to have an effect. And it was not lost on me, of course, that Dale is 15, 16 years old in
the
story.
Probably that pivotal moment in my life caused me to think that moment in a child's life, a woman or a girl or a boy, 15, is likely to be a pivotal time, if only because you begin to be less a child and more an adult, although you don't become an adult necessarily. But yeah, that's how I think of that period of life, and partly because that's the way my life was.
Dale has a twin sister, and the book relates this, but their paths are very different.
They are. They're twins, boy, girl, and she runs away when the parents commit a bank robbery. She runs away to the West Coast. I was trying in a way in that book to sort of, because it's 1960, to sort of intimate that she was heading off to a sort of alternative life, whereas Dale stays and does not experience an alternative life precisely, though he experiences a life in Canada which is different from the life he could have expected. But I wanted her to sort of disappear into what one might have thought of as the counterculture, although the book has little to do with that.
You write in the book, a sociologist of those times, the beginning of the 1960s, might say our parents were in the vanguard of an historical moment, but they weren't. They weren't reckless in the vanguard of anything.
Right, right. That was a crucial line to be able to write at the beginning of the book, because it allowed me to focus exactly on what was specifically not sociological about my book. I wasn't trying to make a sociological point about these people. I think that normal people can do very unnormal things and their life can change forever.
Because there is that inexplicable moment about the bank robbery, which just doesn't quite make sense for these two people.
Exactly. I think there must be, Joe, a time in the lives of anybody who commits a bank robbery when they say to themselves, you know, this is really a bad idea. We really shouldn't be walking into this bank holding guns and stealing other people's money. And that for some reason, probably for every bank robber, it's a different reason, they don't heed that particular warning in their brain. And I was very interested in writing it to sort of trace that particular line of logic, which would lead otherwise familial, nice people to do something very unnice.
When you look at the effect, of course, that this has on Dale and his sister, but Dale is telling the story, and you see a boy, and you can't, yes, he's growing, but he is a boy. And the processing that's going on is quite extraordinary.
Well, I suppose more than most characters that I have written in my life, I mean, I've written 10 books, that's not all that many, I kind of channeled Dell in a way. I mean, I was a 15-year-old boy once, and it isn't, for some reason or other, very hard for me to create plausibly in my own brain the brain of a 15-year-old boy. So I think of him as somebody I channeled there, which is different from how I normally think about characters, in which I don't channel them at all. I sort of make them up whole cloth.
I mean, I'm 44, but I never feel as though I'm that far away from being a 15-year-old boy.
Well, I think we are well off when we can think that way. I think we probably are in trouble when we sort of begin to talk with a deeper voice and think we're adults now and we've put away all these childish things. I'm like you. I never think that the things that I'm doing now or the things that I'm thinking were probably or are probably much different from what I was doing when I was a adolescent. There just doesn't seem to be that dividing line. On the other hand, I never crossed that border either. I never crossed a border and became a criminal. I never crossed a border and became a sociopath. I never crossed a border and went to live in another country. There's been a kind of unbroken skein in my life for the whole of my life.
You mentioned the 10 books, and I just want to take a quick tangent on the fact, and in every review and everything I've seen about this book so far, makes a point that it's been 6 years.
Yes.
That seems to bother readers more than it does you, apparently.
Doesn't bother me at all. I'm always surprised when people think that you can write a really good book in a hurry. I certainly couldn't do it. Also, when The Lay of the Land was published 6 years ago, I was tired, and I had done everything I could do to make that book be good. And so I wanted to just live life a little bit. I didn't want to just sort of bounce out of one thing and directly into another. So I didn't work at all for a couple of years. And then finally sort of eked around to doing it. But yeah, 6 years, doesn't seem like any time at all.
During that point where you're just living, are you thinking about it?
Well, you know, I sort of think that for me, thinking goes on in a way that Henry James describes as the well of unconscious cerebration. I'm thinking about stuff, but I'm not really thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not frontally in my brain. Every once in a while, I'll write a note down. That's the only evidence that I have any cognition at all. Yeah, I suppose I'm thinking about it, but it doesn't feel like thinking. I'm not someplace furrowing my brow or leaning my chin on my palm and staring off. No, I'm probably watching the Red Sox and going fishing or something like that.
Then when it's time for you to write, at what point in the process did you know that Canada was going to be a part of this? Not only the title, of course, but that there would be that escape to Canada.
23 years ago now. I started writing the book in 1989 and then wrote 20 pages and discontinued those 20 pages and started doing something else and always thinking that I'd come back and make Canada be Canada. It was called that then in 89. I don't think I knew what it was exactly going to be formally, but when The Lay of the Land was over and I'd had my couple of years of bivouac, I thought, well, what would I write now if I were going to write anything? That's kind of how I do between books. I sort of bring the whole enterprise back to zero. I thought, well, maybe now I can go back to my freezer and get out this big sheaf of notes that I've been keeping based on my little start back in 89 and see what I've got. Could I maybe make a novel out of this? And I could. I found that I could, that the whole notion of a kid being thrust out of his family, abandoned by his parents and made to go across the border into Canada against his will, still seemed to have what Catherine Ann Porter calls a commotion for me. I could still feel its suppleness as a subject.
When you started writing this 23 years ago, and we've talked about this before, and I always found it fascinating because many fiction writers will tell me that they will start something and then it will not evolve into a full idea, so they'll say this can be a short story.
Mm-hmm.
But for you, from my memory, you make that conscious call at the very beginning. This is going to be a short story. This is going to be a novel.
That's right. But I don't really think that there's probably any qualitative difference between how somebody else does it and how I do it. I just have a vocabulary which is all bound up in controlling what I do and knowing as much as I can know before I start. I think I started writing novels with a great fear of failing. And I think I still write novels with a fear of failing. And so if I prepare, if I think about what I'm doing a lot in advance, then I think I'm less apt to fail, which I always am fearful of. I don't know. I just think if I were to start writing a novel and get 100 pages in and suddenly the whole thing goes kaflooey, I don't know what would happen to me. I just wouldn't like that. Consequently, I've written 10 books and published 10 books and have no books floating around dead in the water anywhere.
Richard Ford is our guest on The Book Show. His new novel is Canada, published by Echo. The language means so much to you. You spend a lot of time on that vocabulary that you spoke of a moment ago.
I do. I read the book aloud to my wife. I read everything aloud every day when I'm writing. I mean, that's what novels are. I mean, they may be stories and they may be word pictures and they may be a lot of things to a reader, but for me, where the rubber meets the road is choosing words. I know I come to the end of writing a long book, and I've got to go over it one last time, very much against my will. And what I'm always thinking I'm doing when I do that is I'm trying to get certain that all the words are in the right place. Mm-hmm. So for me, a novel is language that maybe has this effect on the reader or that effect on the reader, but it's choosing words, so sure. I mean, I want a word to have the right number of syllables. I want a word to have the right vowel sound in the first syllable. Those things all matter to me.
Is that a gameplay in some way that you look and say, well, I could use the word night here, but I would like something with more syllables?
Yes, absolutely. there's a great, I may have told you this story in the past, there's a great little anecdote about Robert Lowell, who was writing a poem, and as happens with poets and fiction writers too, in the middle of one of his lines was a word he didn't like. He kept trying to, go to all the places you go to find synonyms and couldn't find the synonym for the word. And finally what he did was he put not in front of the verb and kept the word that he didn't like, but then he liked the line because it had the right number of syllables in it, even though the sense of the line was reversed by the negative before the verb. So for me, that's how I operate. I will change the sense of a line for a word that I like better that maybe has a different sound or more syllables in it. That, for me, that's discovery.
Your work reads so beautifully aloud, and it is so sound-oriented. And as you stated, you will do that in the process of writing, of reading it aloud.
Yes.
It has to be true to the ear.
It probably does. I will violate that sometimes when I think that the sense of the sentence cannot be reduced to my speaking voice and that the sense of the sentence in whatever complexity it has must be preserved in a way that is not orally pleasing. I mean, readers read books silently, and so they are apt to be, I think, less sensitive to the sounds of words than they are to the whole matrix that a piece of fiction is. And some paragraphs you don't want to simplify down just to the availability of your own voice. You want sentences to be complex, and you may not be able to say them.
But it also brings about a musicality.
Could. It could. I grew up around a lot of poets as a young writer. Galway Connell, and Robert Bly, and James Wright, and Donald Hall.
Good poets.
Really good poets. They were also wonderful readers. Mm. So I came to understand the value of reading things to myself. Consequently, I could pretty much read anything to you and make it sound good, which is a little bit of a liability because it probably threatens me with lying to myself sometimes. Mm. I read everything, and if I like it, I think it's good. Maybe I'm not always right.
But you can sell it.
Yeah, but I have to sell it to myself first, and that's when you have to be the toughest. when you sell it to yourself.
But in the writing of the language, there is, you can show off a little bit.
I try not to show off. I mean, I don't think I have much the capacity to show off anyway.
There's some beautiful sentences in this book.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to make sentences, as much as I say they're about language, subservient to what they mean, finally.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I'm attracted to language, I do want the sentences to make sense in however way they sound.
But you have, as a reader, I wanted, in several cases, to go back and read it again.
Well, that's good. I just want to be sure you get to the end, though.
Oh, right. Well, that wasn't a problem. Okay. You mentioned poetry. You were never drawn to poetry.
No, I never was, except as a reader.
Right.
Once or twice, I've tried to sit down and write poetry. I wrote one line, but I could never write the second one. I would get a great line, but I could never figure out how to add another great line to the first great line. So I just thought to myself, well, fiction's a lot more lenient. Fiction's a lot more forgiving, much more attuned to my abilities.
When you finished Lay of the Land, and was there a, and you mentioned the period after of not working, not only the completion of that book, but the completion of, I don't know the completion, but
it's a completion.
Of a trilogy.
Yeah.
Of saying, okay, I'm done with this.
Yes. Yes.
But there also must come great pride that you were able to create this fictional environment.
Well, I'm so immured in the books. Even years later, I'm pretty immured to the first of those books, The Sports Writer, which is to say, I sort of think about those books from the inside out. I don't ever really get to the point where I can think about books from the outside in. It's just not my talent to do that. So that, in some ways, I think, it stops me from feeling pride. I feel great satisfaction that I wrote them, and I feel great satisfaction that people have read them and occasionally tell me that they were useful books to them. But feeling pride, I guess I just didn't grow up in an environment where we had much to be proud of, except that we loved each other. And so pride was just never floating around the house. I mean, I was a terrible student. No, I couldn't be proud of my grades. I wasn't a good athlete. Couldn't be proud of that. I wasn't very popular with girls when I was young. Couldn't be proud of that. I just got kind of used to not being proud of much, which is okay because novels, much more than they will make you proud, will make you cry because they'll beat you up sometimes trying to write them. So it's better, I think, to be used to that aspect of it than to be prideful.
When you have a book like Independence Day that wins a Pulitzer, wins a Pen Faulkner, great acclaim, do you think that's some of your best writing?
I thought it was the best writing I was doing then. I think to keep on, that's been 16 years ago now, to keep on writing books after somebody's told you that you wrote one well, if you're me, you have to think that you can do it better. You have to think that you're getting better, that you're taking bigger risks, biting off bigger hunks, asking more of yourself. So I think, well, when I wrote Independence Day, it was as good as I could write at the time. Now I feel with Canada, it's probably as well as I can write now. You can tell that I'm just not one of these navel-gazing kind of writers. Mm. I just kind of try to do it and get worry and self-regard out of the way as much as possible because it would just get in the way and slow me down.
You write in the book, my sister and I had no idea about the West except what we saw on TV or even, for that matter, about America itself, which we took for granted as the best place to be. Our real life was the family, and we were part of its loose baggage.
Yes.
These kids, the loose baggage. I guess we're all loose baggage in some way, aren't we?
Well, we could say that about ourselves. Children, particularly, they are the kind of loose baggage of their parents' lives, irrespective of how much they are loved. And these two children were loved. I was loved when I was young, and I was always being hauled around by my parents here and there. It always amazes me when my friends, it's usually my friends in their later years, have young families and they won't go here on a vacation because the child doesn't want to go there. In my family, believe me, if my parents wanted to take a vacation, my opinion was not sought. We just did what they said. So that's how I think of it. I was kind of, they loved me, but I was the loose baggage. They just, you know, pushed me in the car and off we went to Pensacola Beach or someplace like that. But nobody said, Richard, where would you like to go on the vacation this summer? I just thought, well, wherever you're going, I guess.
There's a line at the very early in the book, however, blaming your parents for your life's difficulties finally leads nowhere.
That's a very autobiographical line. There, you know, every once in a while you do, in a long novel like this, write a line that you know to be true, or at least know to express your own opinion about things. I mean, I think there has to come a time in people's lives when they just sort of get off their parents' necks, you know, when they just say, I'm the kind of person I am because I'm the kind of person I am and I'm responsible. So looking back to what they did wrong, and they would have always done something wrong, looking back to that is fruitless. And it really distracts you from your own responsibility, from your own behavior, for your own behavior, yeah.
Even if they rob a bank?
Even if they rob a bank, there will come a day when you'll have to take responsibility for your life. Even if you were thrust out into the middle of cold Saskatchewan in 1960, there has to come a day when it's all on you.
Those passages about cold Saskatchewan are gorgeous.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. I love Saskatchewan, it should be said. I go out there all the time, and I think one of the reasons I set the book there was that the place made such an impression on me when Ray Carver and I went out there in 1984 and went goose hunting. I think we said to each other, we're going to have a race to see who gets this place onto the page first. I actually won, but I'm still doing it 20 years later.
What brought you back to Great Falls?
I just wasn't done with it yet. It just kept on having for me that word that I mentioned before about Catherine Ann Porter. It kept on having a commotion for me. It had, you know, there's a line of Neruda's in which he says that the thing that makes him want to write a poem is that he feels a kicking in his soul. When I go to Great Falls, and I'm not sure, I haven't been back recently, maybe I've used it up, but for the last almost 30 years, when I go to Great Falls, when I think about Great Falls, when I write Great Falls on a piece of paper, I feel that little kicking in my soul that Neruda was talking about. What that means to me is you got to put this in play. You got to set something here. You got to have somebody talk about this place or be in this place. And for a writer, that's an extremely generous gift when a place suddenly makes that commotion exist in you.
Because Dale has this feeling that because he is a military brat.
Yes.
That there really is no place, that he practices of making it sound like it's home.
Right. He lives in Biloxi, and he lives around Air Force bases in Lackland and places like that. In every place he lives, he and his sister, when they start off a new school year in some new town, they say to each other, "Hi, I'm Dale Parsons. I live in Oscoda, Michigan. Hi, I'm Dale Parsons. I live in Great Falls, Montana," just as a way of practicing residence, really, the illusion of residence, which is all he ever has. In a way, I think, though I hadn't thought about it until now, probably coming to Canada, and he ends up at the end of the book living in Windsor, Ontario, was a place of his choosing, a place that he actually made be his because he could choose. It wasn't something that was foisted onto him by even benign parents.
Now that this novel is out, will you live a little before the next one?
Yeah, a long time, I think. I've got a book of short stories about two-thirds finished, which I did before I actually wrote the first of Canada. But I've got another year of work to do on this book of short stories. And I if it's easy, I'll do a little bit.
And if it's hard?
If it's hard, I'll wait.
Take some time.
Yeah.
Richard Ford's new book is Canada. It is published by Echo. Richard Ford, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much.
Joe, you're welcome, and it's a pleasure for me.
Thank you so much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Thanks to WNYC for recording this broadcast. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.
gets cold and can't.